It was pretty terrible.
I haven't actually planned anything quite, but we're in a really grassy spot though, with some really big trees, which is most unusual for this area of Victoria. And nearby there's a little forest of smaller regrowth trees. Doug Ralph, your identity with the bush, what would you call yourself before we talk about the bush itself?
My identity with the bush? Oh, well, I guess I'm a fifth generation descendant of Cornish miners who came here in 1851, and I guess through their long association with the bush and working in the bush, and my father was a real bushman, woodcutter, quarryman, I guess I probably inherited a lot of their, you know, history and stories about the bush, so yeah, that's probably where it comes from.
And so what stories? Can you remember some they told you?
Oh, not really.
Did you inherit it by osmosis?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, it's just sort of something you can't sort of, you have to think about it for a while, but sort of just something that's grown on you over the years, you know, just their knowledge of people and who lived here and it's just sort of, you know, Dad loved working in the bush and always seemed to have a connection with animals and birds. Wherever he worked, there sort of always seemed to be birds, and that would come around the camp, and, you know, he'd have pet wallabies and things like that that would would come into the camp, which, you know, if you know wallabies, they're really shy creature. But, he seemed to have a way of attracting things like that. You know, he knew all the birds and the trees, and seemed to know, have a really good knowledge of, you know, just the natural bush, you know. Even though he was out there cutting it down most of the time, he seemed to have a really good appreciation and understanding of the bush.
Is that common that old-timers, who were probably using hand tools or at best pretty rudimentary machine tools, had to know the bush to work there?
Oh, yeah, I think they did have to. Yeah, they had to understand it. Yeah. I guess they had to understand the seasons. And those blokes who were cutting wood back, or my father was cutting wood probably in the 30s, 40s, and in the early 50s, they would go and, they wouldn't go out there every day, they'd go and set up a camp and camp out there, probably work out there for 6 days and come home on Sunday or something like that. And they were out there all the time, you know, really living pretty close to nature. Probably take a pretty crude sort of a tent and take all their food out for the week. And that's how they done it. And quite often they'd ride their bikes out too. They would, you know, take all their gear out there, and instead of driving out when they come home, they'd take their bikes out with them and ride backwards and forwards on bikes. So that was really common too.
Did he take you out bush with him and you just pick up these things being around your father?
Oh, well, Dad died when I was 10, so I don't remember a great deal about it, but I do remember, you know, sort of going out in the bush, and he just knew, seemed to know it like the back of his hand, really, you know, out in the Friars Ranges and places like that, and out bush out around Malden, and, yeah.
So, how did, from that, it come about your deep feeling and you know, homeliness, knowledge in the bush?
It's just spending a lot of time, like where we're sitting now. I used to go to the Faraday School. Coming home from school would probably take us, you know, 2 hours sometimes to get home from school. So from a very early age, I was wandering around in the bush in this area. I know well before I started school, I was off in the bush, go off with the dog or something, and I was probably only 3 or 4 years old, and I'd go, but probably didn't go that far. It seemed like a big way and when I was a little kid. but I can remember seeing snakes and all sorts of things and managed to survive that. But ever since then, I've always spent a lot of time in the bush and just walked in the bush a lot, and I guess you make a connection with it that way. Like sort of, you can understand the Aboriginals' connection to the land, you know, just being part of it and seeing it and understanding it.
Just going back to your dad for a minute, did those people like your father, did they ever take more wood than the bush could stand?
Oh, I don't know. It was fairly strictly controlled back then. The Forest Commission used to tell them what they could cut and what they couldn't. But I think they cut the bush out fairly heavily, you know. But there was some fairly strict rules about what they had to leave certain trees. The forest officer would go out and mark the trees and that were to be left. And they would just cut out the smaller ones and stack the wood up and leave it to dry. And then they'd have to stack all the heads, you know, the small branches off the... They'd have to stack them in windrows and they'd have to be burnt in the winter. So that was... I don't know whether they abused it or not, but I think they just done it because it was a living and there was a huge demand for wood back then. There was Thompson's Foundry used to have huge numbers of woodcutters carting wood there every day. I mean, I can remember going there with Dad with a load of wood and you'd see about, six or eight other trucks unloading just while you were there. So, and in front of the old hospital up in Barker Street, there used to be a huge wood yard there. It was... probably thousands of tons of wood there that the foundry just virtually ran on wood.
Walking around some of the places out here, maybe right beside us over on our left, where there's a lot of small trees and a lot of coppice trees, five or six smaller trunks coming out of the place where there once was a big trunk. Am I on the right track here? I get the impression that maybe a lot of this district around here, Castlemaine, was fairly well denuded. It could have been pretty bare of land maybe, 50 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty bare of trees, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, there's some good descriptions of this area. There's descriptions of Forest Creek in about 1859, I think. It was described as being totally denuded of trees, not a blade of grass, nothing, virtually nothing left there. And there's photos taken of the... down of the Expedition Pass Reservoir, sort of back set up. You can only see a few little stunted trees in the distance, and you go there now and there's a whole forest grown back there. But there's forest reports done back in the 1880s that we found recently. They described the whole area sort of between Mount Alexander right out to Campbelltown, the other side of Newstead, as being 100% denuded of trees. There was only a little bit of forest left down in the Friars Ranges, so... it's pretty right. There was, this report saying there wasn't a tree left standing within 10 miles of Castlemaine, although there is still the odd old grey box or yellow box was probably too gnarled or too tough to cut down. That's probably the only reason that they were left. And, you could probably, the number of old trees that are left in the area, probably be less than 100.
Have you seen a lot of them? You know where they are?
Oh, yeah, I'm always looking for these old trees and they've got a lot of character to them, so it's good they've got a link with the pre-settlement days, so it's good to, go and stand by one and imagine, what that tree's seen. I'm not sure if we could talk to the trees, they'd tell us a lot of stories.
We can talk to them as much as we like, it's when they start answering back.
Ah, well.
That's when we're either struck gold or we're in real trouble. And so the bushland is growing back. When you look at the old photographs and hear descriptions that you've just made now, there's a lot of people standing up for the environment these days, but, gee, you can reflect and say, crikey, we live in a paradise by our value system compared to what they were living in.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I mean, things have changed really dramatically here in the last few years. People have sort of Well, the first people who came here virtually destroyed the place, and now the people who come here want to repair it and look after it. But it wasn't, even back in, you know, in the gold rush days, people were objecting to the amount of damage that was done. It wasn't, you know, people weren't, that were noticing the damage that was done. You know, probably like now, a lot of creative people, you know, like Ludwig Becker, the German artist, he was sort of appalled to see the damage that was done by the gold rush. And I imagine Governor La Trobe would have been too, because he was a very sensitive artist, a great artist who was friends with Becker, and apparently spent a lot of time in the bush painting and observing what was going on. So you can imagine La Trobe was probably maybe just as outraged about the damage to the environment as he was to people, you know, disobeying the law and taking the land off the squatters. I often imagine he might have been, you know, just as appalled as Becker was.
With the gold rush and what followed, with the decimation of the land, the complete clearing of it, when people around here talk about it, there seems to be two camps. And, you know, those who talk about the glorious days of gold, and those who think of the gold diggers simply as people who were pillagers and little else. Where do you fit into this sort of a discussion, seeing I've just set up the two bookends of what's possible?
Well, I guess, you know, the first one, people who came up here looking for gold were, you know, probably terribly excited by, you know, all the reports were coming on out of these massive amounts of gold that were being taken out of the gold fields. But from what I can see, that the vast majority of people who came here didn't find gold, or found very little gold, and really struggled to survive. And, you know, when you look at the massive amount of damage that's done and compare it with the amount of gold that's been taken out of here, you know, they've estimated that it was the amount of gold taken out of this area is like about 127 tonnes of gold. Well, a tonne of gold is about a cubic foot. You know, that's about that by that. Well, you can't see that by a microphone, can you? But that would amount to about slightly less than seven cubic metres of gold, which you could stack in the average lounge room and still be able to, if the floor would hold it up, and be able to still live in your house. And that's the total amount of gold that was taken out of this area. And you look at the incredible amount of damage that's been done to get that gold. It's sort of no comparison, you know. Sort of, you know, I think it'd be great to do some sort of an installation where you've done a sculpture or something of that amount of gold, and, you know, a whole lot of photos or something, or paintings, you know, depicting all the environmental damage that's been done in this area. I'm actually hoping to get a few artists together to do that one day. So
a landscape of that's been, you know, yeah, Armageddon, with a great big shining lump of gold in the middle. It was it worth it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a fella called, I forget his name now, but he's written a paper called Catalyst or Cataclysm. You know, he says, you know, he argues, you know, was gold a great catalyst for development, or was it a great environmental cataclysm? You know, it's sort of I'm pretty sure I'd come out on sort of the cataclysm side of it. When you look at the you know, amount of people have, just the amount of people have died in pursuit of gold, this the Ballarat Genealogy Society have got a database which is not complete, which has got about 9,100 names on it of people who've died of, from the direct results of mining accidents. So you can compare that with our war dead. It's a pretty amazing number, and that's just the people who've died from accidents, not people who died from lung disease, or, you know, died later on from, you know, all the terrible things, the diseases and that miners got. So, you know, that's another big story.
But cast yourself back to 1850. You don't think you would have caught the fever?
Oh, I probably would have, yeah. Well, my great-great-grandparents were here. I mean, they arrived here with a little toddler and a newborn baby that was born in the Black Forest on the way up here. And I guess it was just a matter of survival for them. You either went and dug for gold or I guess you could go into business selling supplies or something. But first of all, you'd have to get some money. But I think, well, my great-great-grandparents very quickly went into farming and keeping cows. That was sort of what they'd done back in Cornwall. They were miners and dairy, had small dairy farms, and they'd done the same thing when they got out here. I think most people just wanted to get some money and get on and do something else.
Yeah.
Mm.
Which is an interesting thing to consider, I find, when we judge past generations. And often I think people who, you can disagree with me on this, who knock, say, those gold diggers that came here, they, we can be very churlish about them. We've inherited some very beautiful towns that we love to live in from these people. And ironically, as some people say, the bush that they decimated is now coming back because they rendered it almost uninhabitable. So it's the bush that's come back to it.
Yeah, that is, I mean, that is what happened, you know. I mean, I don't knock people for what they've done in the past, but I mean, it's just what's happening now, you know, the people, we've gone the full circle, you know, people, the Aboriginals who lived here first probably cared a lot about the land, and I think we're going back to that, you know, people are learning from, you know, what the Aborigines done here, and, you know, people just want to look after it and care for it now.
It's interesting, I've come here 10 years ago, you've been here for your whole life, to come to a place where, if you cast your eye over the newspapers, particularly leading up to a council election, there is still a bit of a dichotomy going with the old locals calling new locals, you know, coffee swilling blow-ins, and a lot of cynical stuff in the paper about greenies. It seems to me somewhat of a false dichotomy to go forward with.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, I can understand what those people are saying. I mean, I've heard it all. and I can understand where they're coming from. A lot of them have come from, you know, woodcutting families and farming families and that sort of thing. They're still clinging to the past, and but that's slowly changing. I think, you know, another 10 or 20 years, you'll see most of that thinking will be gone. You know, it's, and I know a lot of those people are saying those things, but when you talk to them one-to-one, they love the bush too. Yeah, I mean, they care about the bush, and but they sort of just think you need to carry on the traditions of the past, which I'm not so keen to.
But are they deeper psychological traditions, such as chapter 1 of the Bible, Genesis says, go out and subjugate the birds, the animals, the fish of the sea, etc. Is it an Indian arm wrestle between people whose mind has been set up to exploit the land, and you can still love the bush and exploit it, and those who are starting and beginning and have wholeheartedly sometimes taken on an Indigenous Aboriginal sort of interpretation, where the idea is that it's not ours to exploit, but we have to guard it, protect it, nurture it, and be husbands and custodians to it.
I'm not too sure how to answer that. But, I'm not quite sure how to answer that one.
It feels to me that that's too clear philosophical, psychological, points of view that have to be reconciled for there to be a clear idea of what we're all doing here in this place.
Oh, that's right, yeah, but I mean, it is happening. I mean, we're all... I mean, I think the last 10 years has been fantastic, where it's all sort of come out and we've all had our arguments and there's been huge debates about, you know, what we should do with the land and how we should protect it. And some of us wanted it set aside in parks. And well, I think, you know, there was a certain element there who probably didn't mind the parks but still wanted to have access so they could go out and walk their dog. And walking their dog seemed to be one of the big issues with access to the bushland around here, and I can sort of agree with that because I like walking my dog in the bush as well. So it's something I've done all my life. Yeah, it's a great thing to go out with your dog, and I don't know what it is, but it feels good.
Yeah. It keeps the dog slim, I think.
Yeah, and me, yeah.
So we've gone over, you know, 160 or so years from a bushland that was full of big trees like these few were sitting about here to being cleared to a lot of regrowth. Have you a picture of what will naturally happen if the bush is left to its own devices?
Yeah, I think if it's, I mean, I won't see it in my lifetime, but this bush is slowly thinning itself again. A lot of the smaller trees are starting to die off. You're getting the big trees are starting to dominate again, and it happens over a really long period of time, but you can see a lot of the small stems are starting to die off and the bush will start to open up again. You know, one of the problems with the bush now, there's too much shade in the bush. There's a lot of the plants and that have disappeared because, you know, they don't see any daylight. I mean, it's perfectly obvious on a roadside where there's, you know, no shade or anything, you get a mass profusion of plants and orchids and that, but as the bush gets denser and thicker, the plants disappear. There's a fellow, David Horner, down at Vaughan Springs. He said he can remember in his lifetime up on Porcupine Ridge when they, he said it used to be, you know, beautiful wildflowers right through the bush there, but he said as soon as they cut it out and it all grew back and coppiced up the bush, the wildflowers just shrunk back to the edges of the roads. And I mean, that's what's happened. People, a lot of people feel naturalists and that are worrying about where all the flowers are gone because it's there's too much shade. They need more sun. So, but I think that'll nature will sort it out over the next 50 or 100 years. But it's going to take time. I mean, we could go through and thin it all, which probably they've been doing a few thinning trials in the area, and I do that on my property too, where I'm thinning, and you can see it has an amazing effect, you know. To thin the trees and just leave all the timber laying on the ground, you get a whole lot of, the plants are just sitting there waiting to come back. Once they get a bit of light and a bit of protection from fallen logs and that just all grows back again. So yeah, it's just a matter of time.
Will we one day, or will our ancestors one day see really big trees again growing prolifically in the bush? What's possible?
Oh yeah, I think so. Yeah, there's some really good trees coming back in the bush, you know, especially grey box and yellow box in the gullies, which where they grow really well. I mean, you never did get big trees on the ridges, so the only place you see big trees mainly is in the gullies where there's plenty of moisture. And no, it looks really good. I mean, just where we're sitting now, we're seeing a whole big stand of red gums. You know, imagine them in another 100 years time. There's going to be big spreading. You know, probably maybe just 3 or 4 trees here. A lot of those smaller ones will die out and the big ones will take over and dominate, and you'll have a big sort of open spreading forest, just like Major Mitchell described when he came through here. There's plenty of room between the trees. You know, apparently you could ride a horse through here at a fairly fast rate of knots. You didn't have to worry too much about dodging trees. So big spreading trees with lots of room in between them. You can see a few examples of that down the Friars Range. There's some areas down there that haven't been cut out. You know, there's probably one big tree every, you know, 50 metres or something like that. So it's only when you cut the big trees down that, you know, all the little ones spring up. So they're just waiting there. The seeds are just waiting for their chance to come up. But over a period of time, the one tree will dominate and all the smaller ones will disappear. So.
Like Telstra.
Yeah, Monopoly.
Well, Doug, thanks for the chat.
Oh, okay, thanks. Well, it was good. Seeing yourself walking home from school 50 years ago.